Welcome back. That was Rosa Eskenazi singing Kanini Mugiko, Migaiko, which is sweet, my sweet canary. We are here in the studio now to look at our politics swirling around us. Dr. Lawrence Brown is back in the studio, political activist and public health consultant, assistant professor of public health here in the School of Community Health and Policy at Morgan State University. E.R. Shipp is with us. Shipp is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist in residence, and associate professor of journalism at Morgan State University and the School of Global Journalism. And Lenny McAllister joins us, Republican strategist, former congressional candidate, and you can see his work at LennyMcAllister.com. And Lenny, Shipp, and Lawrence, good to have all three of you with us.
Morning.
Write to us here at SteinerShow at gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages, tweet us at Mark Steiner, and I'll let you know as soon as the phones are working. But you can email us. So let's start, Shipp, if I might. We were talked about, before we went on the air, some of the things that were grabbing you all about the news, and I had my list of a lot of foreign policy stuff. If we get to it, we'll get to it. And Shipp says, well, wait a minute, let's talk about some other stuff, too. I said, okay, well, what? And and we just finished Black Friday. Cyber Monday is among us. Saturday was support small business. But you had something on your mind around that, Shipp.
No, with all the attention being paid to how much money has been spent over the last weekend, one of the things that I think we might lose sight of is that some of the people who are being asked to work longer hours so that we can go and spend this money have some issues. And I think some consumers are beginning to side with them, saying that it's really kind of unfair that you require retail workers, such as those at Walmart and other places, to work on Thursday. People were actually shopping. Black Friday has become something Thursday. I forgot what the term is.
Great Thursday.
What is it?
Great Thursday.
Great Thursday, yeah.
Great Thursday?
Great Thursday. So anyway, it's getting all crazy that and in their desperation to make as much money off of us as they possibly can between the Thanksgiving and New Year's, I suppose, the workers are sort of being asked to work hours and to tap into their family time. So I was struck by that. But in thinking about the workers, I was also struck by the fact that there is actually even a more serious movement afoot. And that is a number of these people who are working in retail and in fast food industry are working at minimum wages. And that's raised a big question for us in this country. It's an economic question, I think, and it's a moral question. How can we expect people to actually live on $7 or so per hour, which is the minimum wage now in this country? So there's apparently some fast food workers are going to go on strike on Thursday.
Across the country?
Across the country, yeah.
And they were doing this in select cities to have the effect of that be more powerful, I think, if I've read that correctly.
Right. I don't have the list of all the cities, but I see Charleston, South Carolina, Pittsburgh, and Providence, Rhode Island were among them. This sort of started in New York last year, I believe, and it's taken off. Last year, 200 workers walked out of some fast food places in New York City and captured the imagination of other workers. They're being supported by one of the unions, I think, the Service Workers Union. But this year, they're expecting a bigger number of people. And the idea is, I think, probably kind of like the fight way back when for the 8-hour workday. It's going to take a long time to get there. There's going to be a lot of resistance. All the doomsayers saying why this would be the absolute worst thing for the economy. But I'm intrigued by what's going on.
And you know, this could be the bubbling up of a new union world in America, because it's been on the wane with the decimation of unions in large industrial industries, which have been torn apart. And Lenny, I'm curious your thoughts on this before we go to Lawrence.
We're focusing on the carrot and not the rabbit. The bottom line is people need jobs that they can sustain their families on and be able to move from poverty into the working class, into the middle class, and raising the minimum wage and keeping people locked in dead-end jobs is not the answer to get American prosperity back up and in full force throughout the different demographics of America. We talk about these food strikes, these fast food strikes and things going on along these lines, but the truth of the matter is if you go into a McDonald's in cities such as Chicago and New York and even down south places such as Charlotte and Charleston, South Carolina, a lot of times the people that are working these jobs are undocumented people in the United States of America. So yes, you can have people go on strike and have American citizens trying to raise that minimum wage, but as long as you have an unfair advantage coming in where corporations and other types of employers will take advantage of the current immigration situation that we have in America, you're still going to have this mess. The truth of the matter is we need the economy to grow the tertiary types of jobs where people can go from entry-level jobs into career jobs, and that is still not the focus of this economy. And unfortunately, with all the back and forth fighting we've had between Republicans and Democrats towards Republicans, that has been lost over the last several years. And as long as we do that, we'll continue to focus on the carrot and move this along. And hooray, we'll move the minimum wage up to $9 an hour or even $10 an hour. But people will be locked in dead end jobs and will still struggle as an American people moving forward through this century, and will continue to lag behind the global economy in regards to education, in regards to innovation, in regards to being leaders from a geopolitical and an economic standpoint.
Well, I think this labor strife is indicative of the decline of the American empire. David Simon in The Wire, that was a big part of his thesis, that as the American empire declines, powerful corporations and institutions become more powerful. And as those corporations and institutions become more powerful, human beings become less valuable and more dehumanized. And so I think that a lot of the strife is really a pushback against that dehumanization. What we need to grow the American economy is more manufacturing jobs, because those are the types of jobs that will allow people to support their family. Historically, we've seen that we need more insourcing as opposed to outsourcing. And we need to close the race gap in unemployment, where the black unemployment gap is, or the black unemployment rate is twice as high as the white unemployment rate. So those are the types of things that we really need to do to make sure that the American worker is sustained, because really these bottom end jobs aren't really going to put people in a position that they need to support their family. So I think we got to look at the root of what's happening here, and that is that American capitalism is dysfunctional, deeply dysfunctional. We saw that in the collapse of the Great Recession. We see that with companies like Enron becoming very corrupt, and we see it when these corporations are not able to raise the minimum wage, even though they're receiving profits hand over fist.
And one of the things that puts the minimum wage issue for a moment, I mean, is that the studies that we talked about in the show on these minimum wage debates, which we will be hearing on this program next Friday as part of our Countdown to the Annapolis Summit, the minimum wage debate in the state of Maryland. But in the larger sense is that the majority of people working now in fast food operations are adults, mm-hmm. not kids. They're not all immigrant workers.
And they're people with children.
Who are... Right, and we've interviewed on the show, and we've met them at different places, and this is where they are. And in the United States, when you look, I was just looking at this kind of description of minimum wage here and around the world, and the U.S. is nestled somewhere between Spain and Greece, but other countries like France, where the minimum wage is close to $12 an hour, or Britain, actually $14 an hour, Luxembourg, where it's almost $16 an hour, that throughout Western Europe, minimum wages are much higher. And so the question, Lenny, I have for you, and then let's go around the room very quickly, is, I mean, it doesn't seem to be adversely affecting the economies, other economies, when you force that wage up. Why do you think it would adversely affect our economy when people are struggling just to survive here?
Well, I think there's two things to that, Mark, that I want to address. Number one, you also look at the work culture over in Western Europe, where men have paternity leave and they have upwards of 6 weeks of paid vacation a year, where here in the United
right.
States the standard is pretty much 2 weeks. So you're talking about a whole cultural shift that you're talking about, not just with select corporations, number one. And number two, again, I caution us to not look at the carrot and forget about the rabbit chasing the carrot. If you look at, for example, the corporations that have made these huge profits after the Great Recession, you look at the banks. There was a period of time where people can go to the banks, not have a college degree, get a certification in IT, or just be skilled at something and make $20 an hour. So here we are focusing on people making $7.25 and trying to move them up to $9 an hour without asking the question, what happened to the banks that used to hire people at $15 to $20 an hour to do something at a desk, to have dignity in their jobs, and still allow these banks to make a significant profit, where the way they made these profits throughout the 2000s and now after the Great Recession is by scaling down those jobs, outshoring those jobs completely, and then reaping in these huge profits. I think that sometimes we as a culture, as a media dynamic, we're looking at the wrong types of jobs that we need to be demanding to come back into the American economy, and stop chasing the minimum wage and say, why can't those individuals go back to being in front of a monitor, doing something that has some dignity, has some worth, and has some potential to grow and make twice as much right off the bat? There used to be a time where kids would go to Manpower and make that $9 an hour just because they knew how to type or could do data entry. We don't even talk about those type of jobs anymore. That's where the conversation needs to shift to, so that people can climb into the working class and middle class, so that we can close that employment gap between blacks and whites. I think that's where we need to start focusing our efforts.
I don't think it's an either-or conversation, though. I think you can talk about the structural changes that are required so that we can create the kind of jobs you're talking about. At the same time, though, we've got to look at this population that we have before us, people who once had some of those more promising jobs and career paths, who are now forced to take these minimum wage jobs in the fast food industry and in retail.
Well, you know, I think a lot of what's being said is very true, but I think we still have to look at these corporations. When you look at the ultimate hilarity of a company like Walmart holding a food drive for its employees, I mean, what does that tell you? I mean, Walmart is one of the richest companies in the world, and they have to hold a food drive for their own employees?
And sell food in their stores.
Right. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, capitalism, which says you have to make a profit on everything, do you really have to do that? I mean, when you make so many profits and billions of dollars of profits, will it really hurt you to pay people a living wage? I think the answer is no. It doesn't. Capitalism can be reformed and done in a way that people still have still have value and worth as human beings, and companies can still make profit. I don't think the two are mutually exclusive.
If the minimum wage, I'll throw this idea, let's see what you all think. And if the minimum wage had kept up with productivity and profit, and you look at the in American businesses, you know what it would be today if it kept up?
$20?
Almost. $17.62 an hour. Mm. Would be the minimum wage if you aligned it with the productivity of the economy. Something's out of balance. You don't think something's out of balance here, Lenny?
I do think there's something out of balance. I think that as well, though, when we went through the last 20 to 30 years of growth from the economy standpoint, coming out of the recession from the 70s, going into the 80s, and then from there, what everybody experienced in the 90s, I think that we started chasing the dollar without chasing all the things that came with the dollar that we experienced in the 50s after World War II and on through. There was a dynamic that allowed us to still lead when it came to education, when it came to innovation, when it came to being the global leaders in a variety of different dynamics and pursuits. We don't have that anymore. The only thing that you have now from an American standpoint as far as leadership is the overall robustness of the economy, because even though we're struggling, we're still that large economy throughout the global scale. But if you look at education, you look at innovation, those things have not kept up. So at some point in time, we have to make sure that those things get leveled off as well, so that there's more value that's coming out of that $17 an hour when it comes to that living wage or that minimum wage that we just do not have or did not have 30 years ago. That dynamic as far as that inequality there between the education of our workforce or the types of skills that our workforce has and can contribute, whether it's from a manufacturing standpoint or from a gray collar standpoint. I mean, these are the type of jobs that we no longer talk about. Just the same, we don't have the same esteem for people that work blue collar jobs like we did 30, 40 years ago. Those type of inequalities must be addressed as well.
Yes.
So that by the time that's taken care of, I think we'll see more of a leveling off and getting closer to that number that you note, Mark.
Now, one of the things that I think, again, though, that when you look at this, we have to take a break, I'm being told. So let's take this break and come right back to a conversation. We're going to bring up what happened with the Caribbean nations, because I think it fits into all this. And I'll throw out some ideas about the context, this question, why they're asking for reparations, how that might fit into the whole question of minimum wage in America, and what is the basis for our system to start with. Does it have any relevance for the 21st century? We'll wrestle with that when we come back, and you'll see what we're talking about. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. On our way here, I want to say something to you. I meant to say at the very top of the hour, and I'll say again next hour, to something we have sent our condolences out. This is very important to all of us here at WEAA and to me personally. You saw the story about the young man, Evan Kerbeam, in Baltimore, who was found in Fells Point. He had been missing. He was found in the water. He was an up-and-coming young man in the Air National Guard. By all accounts, a really lovely human being. Nobody knows exactly what happened. But we did find out. Chris Cager, who's a listener and supporter of EA, sent me a Facebook message last night informing me that Evan was the son of Kevin and Tanya, who own Urban Soul, which is a place that's frequented by many people here at the station and this university and in this community. And so we just wanted to send our condolences out to everyone there in the family. To our friends at that place, and I know it's a very tough time for everybody and this holiday season to have lost a son, lose anybody, but so we just wanted to send that out and remember that here at this moment. I mentioned that at the top of the hour. I'll do that right now. Reminding you also that WEAA is a proud media sponsor for the Morgan State University Choir's Christmas Concert, Sunday, December 15th, 4 p.m. at the Murphy Fine Arts Center. This annual holiday tradition features an array of traditional, sacred, and popular Christmas favorites with orchestral accompaniment. Ticket information at Murphy's Ticket Office, 443-885-4440, or you can just go to Ticketmaster.com. We are here with E.R. Shipp, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who is journalist in residence here at Morgan State University, where she is also associate professor of journalism at the Global School of Communications here. We are here with Lenny McAllister, Republican strategist, former congressional candidate. You can see his work at LennyMcAllister.com. And Dr. Lawrence Brown, political activist, public health consultant, assistant professor of public health in the School of Community Health and Policy here at Morgan State University. Phones are still down, but you can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, and I'll check my tweets here in a moment. You can log on to our Facebook page if you like as well. The only tweet I see is from Lenny McAllister himself, but that's good. So
we know it works.
We know it works. So tweet us. I'll stop right there. I was about to go off into a little riff about tweet, but I won't. So let's jump right into this. One of the things that you mentioned in an email to us last night, Lawrence, mm-hmm. Was what's taking place with the CARICOM countries that are 14 Caribbean stations are suing European countries over slavery reparations.
Right. And the Caribbean community, or for short CARICOM, is basically trying to follow the Kenyan example, where folks who survived the repression of the Mau Mau Rebellion by the British sued and successfully won in court reparations from the former British Empire and the way they were treated during that suppression of that rebellion. And I think it's a great case. Japanese Americans have received reparations here in America for their internment. But people here in America, black people here in America, haven't received reparations. And I think a lot of that's because, of course, racism and the politics of race here in America, where we like to look at black people as victims, particularly if they're poor, the victims of their own devices, and not due to this pernicious effect of racism. But I think that, you know, this does dovetail into our discussion earlier, the dehumanization of the human being, what's going on with worker strife, what's going on in the black community when we look at unemployment being twice as high as it is in the white community. These effects for workers, these effects for vulnerable communities and people of African descent are due to what you raised at the beginning of the show when you talked about James Monroe and the Monroe Doctrine or James Polk and Manifest Destiny, that the wealth that people have today, by and large, is built upon the backs of the dehumanization of others. And I think that's a dynamic that we're going to have to wrestle with, because that is the very heart and soul of capitalism, is the brutalization and dehumanization of human beings so that people who have intergenerational wealth were able to accumulate it on the backs of others. And we got to wrestle with that dynamic.
Well, let me take that a little, push a little, just a little further and go to Lenny and Ship, our other two guests in the show today, program today, to kind of wrestle with this a bit. And please tweet us and get on our Facebook or write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. I want to hear your thoughts on this. That, all right, if taking what you said, Lawrence, mm-hmm. some people would also argue that all of capitalism, Western capitalism in the West, the wealth that was built around capitalism was built because of the slave trade, was built because of slaves, African slaves being sold in America and in the Western Hemisphere. It was slaves. It was rum, sugar, cotton, whole cycle, tobacco, mm-hmm. that was built around that industry that right. built the wealth of the West, Western Europe, and built the wealth of this Western Hemisphere.
Right.
So, and built what we have today as our modern capitalism. That's right. the financial underpinning. As someone wrote in the Jewish Forwards the other day, the editor wrote that everybody has to wrestle with what this is. And he wrote that Jews need to look inside themselves. Where were we in the 19th century? Where were we now that we can go to country clubs that were built on that wealth? Now we're accepted. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Looking at all that in this larger sense. So how relevant is that to the 21st century? That fact, mm-hmm. I think many people don't even accept that fact, though, yeah. that how is that relevant to where we live now, and what should be our response in this 21st century? Lenny, let you jump in first, and then we'll go around the room. And just jump in, folks. Let's jump into this. Lenny?
I think that it is relevant. I don't know if reparations is the answer. I mean, it logically makes sense, but from a pragmatic standpoint, is it something that can actually be put into place, instituted, administrated, and bring about a solution that's going to make a stronger nation as a result? And I would say probably not, between the animosity, the resentment, the technicalities that's going to come into this. If you can't get a website to work for healthcare, if you can't get people to create jobs despite, you know, record amounts of profit, how in the world are you going to get this to work? But to say that it's not relevant in how things have developed in America is very, very untrue. Now, the question then becomes, how do you address the inequalities to provide people an opportunity? This is why I've always argued as a conservative. You know, I go to other conservatives that can't stand affirmative action, that claim that people are playing the race card when you have these things come up. And I constantly say, well, you have these inequalities. Do you want to put programs into place that provide the avenue through which people can get a level footing, therefore prove their worth, therefore get the skills, and therefore at least try to close these gaps? Or do you just say, I don't want to deal with any of this at all? You continue to grow these inequalities, and thus you rip apart your nation at the seams. Reparations probably cannot come about in America ever, but you can put programs into place that will allow folks to get over the aftermath of these type of policies, because it wasn't just slavery that American blacks went through. After slavery, you had 100 years of institutionalized racism that kept people at a second-class status. They locked them away from the best education, locked them away from the best jobs. You had people that locked folks away from union jobs and everything else. And now you've had basically 40 to 50 years tops of having policies that are trying to reverse 300 and some odd years of discrimination. You have to put more into it. It doesn't necessarily have to be dollars, but it does have to be something that understands the inequality and the impact that it has on allowing America to be as great as possible. This is not just a black problem. This is an American problem that we have to address.
I hear you, and I pretty much agree with you on that. But to go back to your Republican brethren and sisters, one of the ways we've tried to address this inequality has been affirmative action. And as imperfect a solution as it is,
It is necessary.
It's necessary, and a lot of conservatives totally reject it, despite the kinds of arguments that you're making that make perfect sense. On the other hand, there's another part to this argument, too. Those who are arguing for reparations often cheapen the argument by saying that they want it to be a dollar amount that each black person in America receives. I think that's an insult to the whole history of what black people have suffered over the years. So on one hand, you have total resistance to thinking about addressing inequality. And on the other hand, you have people who want just a dollar or check to pay for what suffering their ancestors may have gone through, let alone whatever they may have gone through.
Well, I think the points that are raised are really fantastic here. I mean, the mechanism of reparation is certainly a question, but I think what Lenny is saying about the history of race in America, there is no dispute that that black people have been adversely impacted by racism. Now, when he said understand what it is that we're dealing with, we have to understand that in terms of wealth, white folks own 20 times the assets that people of African descent in this country does. So there's a huge wealth disparity. Then let's look at health. Black people live shorter lives, experience greater burden of disease, were mistreated in medical research. Many of our greatest universities, the Harvards and Yales, were built by slaves and employed scientists and researchers that created a pseudoscience of race and phrenology, you know,
and
measuring
skulls.
Some of
their endowments are
right. Their endowments, the trustees, many times were slave owners. We're learning that business management techniques were learned and refined on plantations. So again, the way that this system has been set up has really advantaged white folks and disadvantaged black people. And there's a long history of that. When we talk about affirmative action, though, I think we ought to be clear. White people have had many programs of affirmative actions. White people had an affirmative action program when they had slavery. White people had an affirmative action program when they committed the genocide of Native peoples and took the land of Native nations. You know, Social Security was originally given to people who worked jobs that were not domestic workers. Well, who was in domestic jobs at those times? Who was working many of those domestic jobs? African American people. So they were excluded from a lot of the programs in the New Deal. And that's something we don't talk about. There's a book that speaks to that by a brother named Iron Nelson, if I'm not mistaken, When Affirmative Action Was White. So white people in this country have been the beneficiaries of 300 years of affirmative action. And it is a really crazy thing to say that in only 40 or 50 years of half-baked attempts of affirmative action in this country that black people are somehow made whole. That's really ludicrous.
And I think that one of the things that people forget about when we talk about discrimination is the fact that on the flip side of discrimination of that same coin on the other side is an advantage. So if somebody is being discriminated against, it's because it puts somebody at an advantage. And so how do you neutralize, maybe not necessarily neutralize the advantage from 150 years ago or even 75 years ago, but how do you create a situation where somebody can build an advantage for themselves without necessarily punishing a 27-year-old that may not have had anything to do with their great-grandfather's deeds but still sits on the laurels of what transpired 75 years ago? Because if you don't have that great, wise, and very tenuous type of negotiation of how you do this, you create a situation where you can, again, rip people apart at the seams. And by the way, you're talking about generations and Generation X and the millennial generation that view race completely differently than what the greatest generation and the baby boomers viewed race as. So it's a very cautious path that we have to go down, but it's one we have to walk down with confidence that we have to make sure that we do not ignore.
Well, there are two questions here that maybe in the larger sense some of this wrestles with as well that we don't wrestle with. I mean, one is if we understand, if this discussion of reparations, I think that in some ways, Lenny's point is that it's going to be very difficult to get reparations in terms of dollars and cents into people's individual bank accounts. I think we can argue that. I think it should be argued, but that's part of what's being said. But this discussion about why this discussion has to happen and what the basis for our system even is important in terms of why we have the issues we have today in the 21st century. I mean, I think that's right. That's something that I think is almost as important, if not more important. But reparations, maybe is that taking the form of rebuilding communities and cities, putting people to work? I mean, is that
right? I think, you know, I mean, that was where Occupy Wall Street fell short to me, is that they didn't realize, they didn't articulate that the roots of Wall Street advantaging Main Street, being advantage over Main Street, you know, was rooted in this dynamic of enslavement, Holocaust, genocide, people of Native descent and people of African descent. And I think that, yes, we ought to be able to think, you know, living wage is a form of reparations. Rebuilding communities without gentrification and displacement is a form of reparations. Making sure we have equal sentencing for substances like crack cocaine and powder cocaine. That is reparations. All reparations really means is to repair and to make whole that which was damaged. And people of African descent have been severely damaged by racism. That doesn't mean we didn't fight back. It doesn't mean that we don't have a great history of pushing back against these forces. But it did severely damage us. And I think to come to terms with that, to reconcile ourselves with that history, will only strengthen America, because right now race is an open wound on the body politic. You know, it's like a gunshot wound that we've never bandaged, and we got to deal with that.
But who is the we? That becomes the issue. We can't hope that these pathetic politicians who are supposedly leading us to some promised land can actually do so. So where is that conversation going to start? It's easy to start it in the halls of academe, of course, but how do we take it to where it means something? I don't know the answer to that.
Number one, you got to understand that we talk about pathetic politicians that we vote into there. We talk about pathetic politicians that we allow to be there because of the money that's involved in politics, and we allow that to drive the conversation. We allow people to stay in office for 20, 30 years to make these type of policies and to make this type of dynamic within the body politic that allows us malaise towards the race disparities between socioeconomic disparities to continue. That's number one. Number two, I think that it really does start with conversations like this, but I say this all the time, both to my conservative brethren as well as to my African-American brethren. When are you willing to sacrifice everything to create a new standard of justice? Because previous generations did this, and I say this, I get criticized all the time. Generation X with African Americans is probably the most selfish generation of black people in the history of America, because we have refused to sacrifice everything, if necessary, in order to elevate the standard of justice, whether it comes to racial disparities, whether it comes to our kids going to jail in a new Jim Crow, whether it comes to our kids being locked out of jobs as far as our black youth at a rate of almost 50% in some cities. You will see other generations raise holy hell to change that. And Generation X, by and large, if we're in the black middle class, we're driving a BMW, we have a four-bedroom home, we don't do as much as we could or should do. So it not only goes to getting those pathetic politicians out of office, regardless of the money that they push in their campaigns, but it also goes to us being willing to sacrifice all. There are plenty of people that caught bullets and wore nooses around their necks because of us, and we won't even so much as put it on the line and make sure that, hey, I might have to jeopardize a job here, I may have to jeopardize my home here to bring about a sense of justice 30 years down the road. That has to shift.
Well, I agree with much of what you're saying, Lenny. The one pushback is, I don't know if we can overgeneralize about Generation X, you know, this generation of black people, young black folks that's living now, because even though we have this great history of the civil rights movement, all black people weren't engaged in that, you know. That's people may make it seem like, you know, I was there. You were there, but were you in it? Right?
Some were not even there.
Right, and many were not there. Many pushed back against Dr. King. Many hated Malcolm. So, didn't like Fannie Lou Hamer or Assata Shakur. So, you know, everybody wasn't involved then, but we looked at the pushback against the acquittal of George Zimmerman, the Gina 6 protests. I'm not so sure that young black people in today's time are not willing to put something on the line to make sure that they have a better sense of justice.
We don't have the persistence, though. I mean, look at the persistence. I mean, we protested George Zimmerman. We had some marches around the city Florida still has the income flow that they have. You look at some of the other things that have transpired between stop and frisk in New York City. New York City with stop and frisk, even with it being in place today, with the generation before us, would have shut New York City down. Manhattan would have had stores that just did not have black dollars flowing through it. Nowadays, as we protest for about a week, and just as the news cycle changes, so does our attention. I do say that we as Generation X need to step it up a lot more than we have.
And I think that there's been a recent study in the New York Times showed about Generation X is that they're crossing racial lines. They are they're a generation that's looking more towards what we can do to help and do things that go into and occupations that help repair what we have and help human beings as opposed to being selfish. I think sometimes this generation is maligned a bit.
Yeah, we get a bad rap.
I think you all get a bad rap. I really do. But let me just throw this thing out to you all before we conclude here. I just want to throw this phrase out. When we talk about reparations, there's a great Hebrew phrase. It's called Tikkun Olam. And Tikkun Olam means repairing the world or healing the world. And maybe it's time that we have this reparations Tikkun Olam conversation around us to talk about what this means for the century. I think we need to have this. It needs to be pushed in serious ways in our universities, in our high schools, and middle schools for people to kind of begin to, and communities, to wrestle with what the legacy we have of 400 years in this country, what it means for the future.
Because ultimately, reparations is not about the pain of the past. It's about making people whole.
For the future.
For the future.
Exactly.
So, one of the things that, you know what they're doing in Switzerland right now? Have you seen that's on the referendum? You know, in Switzerland, how they have referendums and they decide laws the entire country. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're not in terms of people's rights. But what they're doing now is they are voting on two things. One of them is for a minimum salary for everybody in the country that would be equivalent of $25,000 to $30,000 a year in this country, so that everybody has a place to start from. Some will be lazy and sit home. The vast majority of people will not. They'll use that as a way to take care of their families and then go off and do some interesting things. This is becoming a movement all throughout Europe at the moment and other countries for a minimum salary for every person in the country to start off with. That's A. And B, there's a referendum that would not allow corporations and their leaders to make more than 10 times what a worker makes in the factory or their business. These two things are now taking hold in Switzerland that are then going to, I think, go across Europe and could affect a conversation globally about where we need to go.
Definitely they will affect the conversation. They would definitely affect the conversation. That reminds me, by the way, of a statistic I wanted to mention earlier when we were talking about minimum wages. I saw in a Bloomberg piece, I think, that a Chicago McDonald's worker making $8.25 an hour would have to work for more than 100 years to match the 8.75 million dollars that the company's chief executive made in 1 year in 2011. So we definitely need to have these conversations. There have been these conversations in the past about whether we should have a minimum salary for everybody, and those conversations have gone absolutely nowhere because we do focus on, well, people, it would be incentive for people not to be productive. And I think we get hung up on that and we don't go beyond that. We also talk about, are we becoming a socialist nation, you know, with the guaranteed income, all of that. So we've had bits and pieces of this conversation over the decades. We've got to figure out a way to take it further so that we don't get hung down, bogged down on things like socialism.
Well, you know, the other component I think we need to think about with fast food, and as a public health guy, I got to talk about, you know, is the product that they're putting up forward, you know, the quality of food and what's going on with health in this country. Again, you know, corporations that make money off the misery and the dehumanization of others, you know, if you're eating McDonald's every day, you know, that's not good for your health. And we have a lot of people that are doing that, you know, trying to make ends meet by doing so. And, you know, I appreciate some of the things that McDonald's is doing to, you know, improve and offer more healthy food items. But I think that's another part of that discussion as well, because when you look at the globalization of these companies, I went to Honduras in the summer and saw Church's Chicken there. I was really shocked.
No.
I was like, Church's, they got Church's Chicken in Honduras. And it's like, well, what are they going to do? I didn't see a lot of obese people there, but I'm wondering what's going to happen when I go back in 20 years.
The two things about that, let me just give a commentary. You know, that over 60% of Generation X think socialism is a good word. And 36% of Americans now out and out say we think mm-hmm. it's a positive way. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a conversation that's shifting a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, you know, talking about what's going on in Latin America, did you see the article about what happened in Mexico? They're passing a law that puts serious taxes on candies and sodas because the United States is the second most obese country in the world. Mexico is the most obese country in the world. Since NAFTA, it's exploded obesity.
Right.
So they're trying to take charge of that by doing that. So I find those kind of things. These are
because you got to look at the intersection between health and labor. You know, how much are people going to be able to work if they're unhealthy?
So I have to tell our listeners, I'm sorry that some people are trying to call the number, but the phone system is down, so we cannot take your calls. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. And if you're not of the tweeting generation, just jump on Facebook and leave your comment there. We'll bring it that way. Or send an email if you're not driving, sitting at your desk or sitting at home or wherever you are at the moment. SteinerShow@gmail.com. We just cannot take your calls until they repair the phone system. You know, you can't get upset about stuff you can't control. So, Lenny, we have about 4 minutes left, and we haven't heard your voice in a few minutes.
Well, I, you know, the number that you quote in regards to Generation X and socialism at 60% and other Americans throughout at that 30+% clip, that's dangerous. That should be cause for concern because now we're talking about, and it goes back to what I said before, we're talking about there should be some guarantees out there. We're not talking about generations prior to that came to this country, whether we're immigrants from Western Europe, Eastern Europe, et cetera, or people migrating from the South coming up saying, I will build something. I will, even if I have to start here, as long as there's a pathway to get me to the next level, as long as there's a guarantee that if I work hard enough, I can obtain that I will not be held from getting that because I'm Irish, Italian, an immigrant from Mexico, from Alabama, and the grandchild of a slave. That's a different conversation than saying that we need to have a certain element of socialism infused in America. I mean, again, I say this all the time. There are no socialists out there selling drugs in the south side of Chicago at 1 o'clock in the morning in February. They're capitalists just focused on the wrong thing. There is still a capitalist element involved in America, even at the depths of despair in the ghettos in the worst cities of America, including Baltimore.
So
what do you do to inspire that is the question, not necessarily putting levels in place that will level out, you know, what people will make, et cetera, because we have too many examples around the world throughout the last 100 years of what socialism does to a nation overall, and that is not the path that America should go down.
Well, I don't know. I've spent time, you know, I think Sweden, France, Great Britain, Germany, they had a basis for a democratic socialism, not complete socialism, that where there is equality, where there are equality of wages. One of the things that Dar wrote in, tweeted two things. She said, programs will not move us to reparations. Policies are needed here, and there is not the political will for that. And she wrote, tweeted again, saying, justice is different from repair. Increasing minimum wages, et cetera, is not about justice. It's about justice, not repair or the economic impact of slavery.
Well, I disagree with that. I mean, to the degree that unemployment is twice as high for African-American people than it is for white folks. And it's persistently been that way for 50 years. It's clearly due to structural inequality. So to make sure that people have a living wage is certainly part of repairing the unemployment gap that we've had in this country historically. So I appreciate the heart of the comment, but I would push back and say respectfully that reparations can be about more than just putting money in somebody's bank account. It can be about providing free education, providing health care, providing living wages for workers.
I think
I'm going to go back to what you said European countries.
Lenny, I'm sorry, we're out of time. It looks like my producer is saying, I have a chat, but my chat's gone. Chap is back. Now it says wrap it up. I lost the chat. It came back. Didn't know what my directions were. Now I know what they are. My directions are it's time to go, at least for this segment of our show. And Lenny McAllister, always a pleasure to have you with us.
Appreciate being here as always.
And go to LennyMcAllister.com for more, and we'll link to that. Ship, always great to have you in the studio. Thank you so much. And Dr. Lawrence Brown, good to have you here as well.
Have a great day.
You too. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back from that break, we're going to be leaving here with some old Odetta. She passed away on this day. Waterboy from the 1960s. We'll be hearing a more modern piece that she did a little bit later, but this is Waterboy by Odetta. And we'll come back with Leah Gilmore as we look at the wonderful life of Ruby Glover and then wrestle with what happened at the American Music Awards. Stay with us. Don't go away.